Hey, good morning, everybody. The plan this morning, as we spoke about last week, is to speak about Inyanei Purim, about the issues related to Purim. To that end, I wanted to really just share, really, lock, stock, and barrel, a beautiful approach to many of the events in the Megillah from Rav Soloveitchik Zatzal. This presentation, which was originally given by Rav Soloveitchik as a yard site, as a shiur on the yard site of his wife back in 1973, has been written up a couple of different times. This particular version of the shiur was published a few years ago in a book entitled Days of Deliverance, Essays on Purim and Hanukkah. So shockingly enough, in that book on Essays on Purim and Hanukkah, you find this shiur about Purim. Maybe we'll hold off Hanukkah for some other time. As many of us may know, Rebbetzin Soloveitchik passed away on Tainis Esther in 1967. So basically from that time on until he was no longer able to do so, Rav Soloveitchik used to give a shiur, you know, on or near Tainis Esther as the, you know, to memorialize his wife. And of course, if you're giving a shiur on or near Tainis Esther, it stands to reason that one is going to speak about issues that have to do with Purim. So let's present some of the ideas from the shiur, and again we'll see how it illuminates some of the story of Purim in a somewhat unique way. We know that the Megillah is referred to as Megillas Esther. Obviously, Esther is the heroine of the story, is a very, very important person in the story. It's interesting that the Megillah is referred to as Megillas Esther and not Megillas Mordechai. Because the truth is, if you look towards the end of the Megillah, the one who seems to be putting down all of the laws about the new holiday of Purim, indeed the one who seems to be writing to the Jews and telling them, you know, we're going to have this new holiday, these are the laws of the new holiday, he seems to be writing down the Megillah itself towards the end of the Megillah. The one who does all of that is Mordechai. So you would think at least that the Megillah would be referred to as Megillas Esther Mordechai, Megillas Mordechai the Esther, maybe Megillas Mordechai altogether. Why Megillas Esther? Why is Esther singled out specifically to be the one after whom the Megillah is called? So Be'ezrat Hashem, we'll come back to this point towards the very end, but first we'll lay down a couple of issues that present themselves in the story of the Megillah itself. So we're familiar with the description of what happens in the first parak, the first chapter of the Megillah. Vashti refuses to come before Ahasuerus. Ahasuerus is enraged, and he consults with his advisors as to what should be done. So one advisor in particular, Memuchan, whom Chazal say is going to reappear a little bit later on in the Megillah with a different name, will be renamed Haman. Memuchan and Haman, according to Chazal, are one and the same person. So Memuchan makes the following suggestion to Ahasuerus. Says Memuchan, if Ahasuerus tolerates the failure of Vashti to come before him, so you know what's going to happen. No women in the entire Persian Empire are ever going to listen to their husbands ever again. If the queen doesn't listen to the king, so what's to stop every woman throughout the kingdom from disobeying her husband? Such a thing cannot be, says Memuchan. So first of all, Vashti should be put to death for her insubordinance, and the king should send out a new rule that all women are obligated to listen to their husbands and send it throughout the 127 provinces of the Persian Empire. So you read this, and it seems on a certain level a little bit comical. I mean, imagine you're, you know, getting the mail one fine day in the Persian Empire, and you get a letter, it's an official proclamation from the king. Hear ye, from here on in, all wives have to listen to their husbands. The king's meddling in this kind of stuff, the king's meddling in domestic manners, and, you know, what kind of rebellion are we worried about happening over here? You know, all the wives are going to rise up against their husbands, and the Persian Empire is going to fall? I mean, it seems comical, it seems like a farce on some level. So the fact that anyone can make such a suggestion, And the fact that Achashverosh could accept such a suggestion, even in a drunken stupor, and say, yeah, that's a great idea. The new rule that we're going to put out for the entire Persian Empire is that all wives have to listen to their husbands. It just seems a little bit bizarre. So the truth is, Chazal already, in one of the Midrashim, point to the fact that this is bizarre. And they say that all of this is part of the Hashkacha, part of God's divine providence, to kind of lay the groundwork for the people not really thinking highly of Achashverosh. In other words, they say, you know, this is a silly decree. So if the king could make a silly decree like this, when he sends out a decree that all of the Jews should be slaughtered, they're a little bit skeptical of the thinking process that goes behind the decree. So there's already Chazal hinting at the fact that, yeah, you know, we're right to think that this is a rather silly and nonsensical decree, you know, for the king to insert himself into the middle of domestic disputes. You know, I mean, you can imagine, you know, should we take out the garbage? You should take out the garbage. No, you should take out the garbage. You should take out the garbage. You should take out the garbage. Well, I have a letter signed by the king that says that if I say you have to take out the garbage, you have to, by golly, you have to take out the garbage by order of the king. It's silly. It sounds silly. It sounds ridiculous. But how does one justify the idea? So the Rav gives a very, very interesting insight into this seemingly silly decree. And it's an opening in many ways to help understand what's going on in the Megillah. Chazal tell us that Achashverosh was a commoner who had married into the royal family. Vashti was either a daughter or a granddaughter, depending on different versions of the Midrashim. She was either a daughter or a granddaughter of Belshazzar, who was the last king of the Babylonian Empire. And Belshazzar was a grandson of Nebuchadnezzar. So in other words, Vashti really came from the royal Babylonian family. The Babylonians, as we know, the Babylonian Empire was conquered by the Persians. So Achashverosh, who had been, according to Chazal, a stable boy, somebody who came from a very, very common background, had essentially married up. In other words, when he became part of the Persian royalty, in order to demonstrate his royal bona fides, you know, the fact that he was entitled to the throne, he married somebody who came from the family of the conquered Babylonian Empire. This way he would show everybody that he was really, really, you know, fit to be a king and to be part of the royal family. Nonetheless, Achashverosh was always unsure about that role that he occupied, and in the Rav's words, he actually suffered from paranoia. He was a very, very paranoid person. He thought at any juncture, people are going to catch on to the fact that I don't really deserve to be in this position. I just married a princess. I'm not a prince myself. And, you know, when a person is paranoid, so they start imagining and suspecting all kinds of revolutions that are going to take place around them because they see enemies in every corner. What was true of Achashverosh was likely true of many other couples in the empire, just on a lower scale. Especially in those days, when one country conquered another country, the women of the conquered country were very often taken to be wives of the conquerors. So this was true in a very, very obvious sense in the case of Achashverosh and Vashti. But it was probably true in a lesser sense for many, many other couples around the empire. There were probably many, many couples where Persian commoners married Babylonian women of royal background. Now, in light of that supposition, consider what's maybe not such a nonsensical decree, which is suggested by Memuchan. Memuchan comes to Achashverosh, and he says, Vashti's refusal to come is not just a domestic issue, and it's not just your issue. Her refusing to come is essentially saying that the Babylonian Empire and its descendants refuse to be subservient to the Persian conquerors. This has big implications, because if this is going to be true all the way up at the top, imagine all of these other hundreds of families where a woman of Babylonian royal background is married to some Persian commoner. If the Babylonian queen is not listening to the Persian king, so then they will rebel against their husbands as well. It's not a question of taking out the trash, not taking out the trash, doing the dishes, not doing the dishes. But it's a question of, do we accept the power of this conquering body, namely the Persian Empire? Are the Babylonians willing to continue to subjugate themselves to the conquering Persians? So it's interesting. Right, so in other words, it's an interesting thing. I don't think the Rav is saying that exactly. In other words, I don't think he's saying that, you know, he was worried about feminism per se. I mean, that's kind of taking modern terms and throwing the bag. But in other words, specifically here, because the women represented the old empire, and the men in many cases represented the conquerors, you know, this could really be an undoing of the Persian conquest of the Babylonian Empire. You know, it happens to be split along gender lines because the men from the old Babylonian Empire were generally killed. The women were kept alive, and they were just, you know, they married the conquerors, so this way they were still there, they were a force. But as long as we keep them down, so then we don't have to worry about an uprising in the empire. But the minute these women who are Babylonians start feeling that, you know, they can talk back against their Persian conquerors and witness the fact that it's happening all the way at the top, so that's going to lead to pandemonium. Is that reasonable? It's at least more reasonable than saying that they're going to fight, you know, they're going to be domestic disputes, and we have to do whatever we can to quell these domestic disputes to get the women to agree when their husbands say, you have to do the dishes, you have to take out the garbage, which again just seems like a strange thing for the king to be involving himself on that level. Achashverosh is paranoid. So when Memuchan says, if you don't take action, the entire empire may start unraveling, a paranoid person listens to that right away. So Vashti is killed. We have to get a new wife who's going to be subservient in the sense that she's going to recognize the conquering Persian powers, and hopefully everything will disappear. We fast forward a little bit to Perek Beis, to the end of the second chapter in the Megillah, and we find the story of Bigthan and Teresh plotting against the king. Says Rav Soloveitchik, it's not just an accident that these two individuals are plotting against the king. I guess every king has people who don't like him. But consider this against the backdrop of the fact that Achashverosh has really, in many ways, usurped the throne. He's a commoner who's come to the throne. He married into the royal family. He doesn't really deserve to be there. He's not really from any kind of royal family whatsoever. And presumably throughout the Persian Empire there were people who resented Achashverosh and wanted to get rid of him precisely because of that. But it feeds the paranoia that Achashverosh has to begin with. Two of your close courtiers are trying to kill you. You know, if you're a paranoid person, it doesn't make you feel less paranoid, you know, because they're trying to kill you in the middle of the night. What happens immediately after Bigthan and Teresh are executed? So the pasuk says, "Achar advarim ha'ele gidal hamelach Achashverosh es Haman." Achashverosh, right after Bigthan and Teresh are executed, makes Haman his chief advisor. Now, if you think about it, the logic behind that is a little bit hard to follow. Who's directly responsible for having thwarted the plot of Bigthan and Teresh? It's Mordechai. So, if you think anyone would be elevated to a position of prominence, it should be Mordechai. You know, the king knows that Esther was involved. You know, Esther told the king in the name of Mordechai that Bigthan and Teresh were plotting to kill the king. And yet we don't see that Esther is elevated in any way, that Mordechai is elevated in any way. Who's elevated? Haman. So why is Haman elevated? So since Rav Soloveitchik, let's put two and two together from the point of view of somebody who's a paranoid person. Memuchan / Haman told me way back when that there were enemies plotting against me and we had to take extraordinary steps in order to secure the kingdom. I see that he's right. I see that people are trying to kill me. So the only one who can protect me against my enemies is that Memuchan, is that Haman, who was so protective of me back at that Sa'uda, back at that royal feast, when he protected me against my own wife, against Vashti, and against all of the women of the Persian Empire, the Babylonian women who had been pressed into submission. Haman protected me then. He's the right person to have in a position of prominence to protect me now. So again, we begin understanding, you know, from the point of view of someone who's paranoid, why the plot of Bigson and Teresh should all of a sudden lead to Haman being appointed to his position of prominence. Where did Haman come from? You know, where did this guy come from to be the second in command in the entire Persian Empire? Ahasuerus trusted him. Right. And Achar Advarim Ho'ele, according to Chazal, means immediately after these things, because of these things, because of what happened with Bigson and Teresh. You know, that's why Haman was elevated to his position of importance.
And nobody from Vashti's family had anything to just say about anything?
Well, because that was the conquered family. In other words, all of the men, all of the men in that family had been killed.
So that this, her royalness was gone.
Right. In other words, all the men in that family had been killed. That was probably the first thing the Persians did when they came into, when, you know, they conquered the Babylonian Empire. And, you know, no one would protest, because the whole point was, it wasn't just about Vashti's personal issues with Ahasuerus. You know, it was perceived as the Babylonians trying to rise up again, and Ahasuerus says, we've got to put these Babylonians in their place, let them understand they may be royal family, but it doesn't matter, they were conquered. And that's what's going on behind the scenes with that whole interaction. So this then leads us to another aspect of the story, which on the surface is also difficult to understand. A lot of very There are a lot of gaps when we try to figure out the story of the Megillah, and a lot of things which are not immediately obvious as to why they played out in the manner in which they played out. So when the decree is promulgated by Haman, so as we know, in the beginning of Perek Daled, the fourth chapter, Mordechai sends for Esther, and he tells her everything that's happened. And he says, you know, you got to go before the king. You got to go before the king and beg on behalf of the Jewish people. Esther agrees. But Rosalechik points out that what Esther agrees to and what Mordechai seems to be suggesting are not 100% the same thing. Mordechai and Esther seem to have different tactics as to how to undo the decree against the Jewish people. Esther's tactic we know, because we read about it in the Megillah. But Mordechai's tactic, if you read the Psukim carefully, seems to be the following. Esther, your people are in danger. Go before the king. Go without asking. That part she does do. Go before the king and right away plead that the decree should be undone. In other words, if you read Mordechai's words to Esther, Ulevakesh melefanov alama, right, you know, he says to her, go and just, you know, plead in front of the king. The vision that Mordechai seems to have is that Esther is going to go right in front of Ahasuerus and right away say, I'm a Jew, the Jewish people are in trouble, there's a decree which has been promulgated against them. Please, 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 Ahasuerus, please do whatever you can to cancel the decree. That seems to be the plan that Mordechai suggests to Esther. Esther, as we know, does not do that. Esther risks life and limb to come before Ahasuerus. He stretches out the scepter. She comes in. And what's her request? I'm making a party. Would you like to come to the party? That was clearly not what Mordechai asked her to do. Where on earth did that idea come from? And then, once she invites him to one party, what's her request at the party? We're going to have another party. Right? So we're going to have another party, and it's only at that second party that Esther reveals that there's anything amiss, and ultimately in the aftermath of that second party, that's when Haman is put to death. Why this very elongated process of a party and then another party? We have a problem. You know, the Jewish people are slated for destruction. Just go in there and start pleading. So says Rav Soloveitchik, if you understand the paranoia of Ahasuerus, which Esther did, because she spent, unfortunately, a lot of time with him, if you understand the paranoia of Ahasuerus, you understand that the last thing that would be effective would be to go in before Ahasuerus and say, your evil Prime Minister Haman is plotting to destroy our entire people. Because the paranoid Ahasuerus would say, wait, Haman is my protector. Haman is the person who helped me get rid of that evil Vashti. Haman is the person who predicted that Bigthan and Teresh would be trying to kill me. Haman is the only protection that I have who will make sure that I'm not vulnerable in any way. If it comes down to a choice between Haman and Esther, at that point, when Esther first goes before the king, Ahasuerus would have chosen Haman in an instant over Esther. You're trying to tell me that Haman is working against me? I understand why Haman wants to get rid of this terrible people. They're different. And people who are different are a threat. And again, from the point of view of somebody who's paranoid, he's not in a position to listen to reason or discussion or anything like that. The had it come down to a choice between Haman and Esther, he certainly would have chosen Haman over Esther. So Esther intuitively, and here the Rav says this is a prime example of what Chazal say, that women are blessed with Bina Yisera, with an uncanny, unusual insight into what to best do and how to best deal with people, how to best deal with situations, because Mordechai's plan would have fallen flat on its face. Mordechai's plan, namely, of having Esther go in and just start pleading before Ahasuerus, probably would have gotten Esther executed, right on the spot. But because Esther goes in and doesn't start pleading, and she doesn't try to portray Haman as an evil person, she says, no, the opposite is true. I want you and Haman to come with me to a feast. I want to show my subservience to you, O Ahasuerus. I want to show my recognition of that individual whom you see as being your protector. So Ahasuerus' spirits are lifted by that. His ego is stroked, so to speak, by that. And the paranoia, which otherwise would have made Esther into a kind of an enemy, she's able to break through that veneer of paranoia in order to make Ahasuerus feel comfortable. Why does she have the two meals? Why does she invite Ahasuerus and Haman, not just once, but twice, to dine together with her? So Soloveitchik suggests the following. Esther didn't really know how things were going to play out. But she knew that in order to win Ahasuerus over, the only method that she had was to somehow get Ahasuerus in his paranoia to turn against Haman himself. Right now, Haman can do no wrong. But if the king can somehow perceive Haman as being an enemy himself, somebody who himself is looking to harm the king, that's the only way that Esther says to herself that I stand a chance of being able to convince Ahasuerus to overturn the decree and save the Jewish people. So according to Rav Soloveitchik, what she's doing by inviting him to the two feasts is buying time. Let's see what happens. Now again, you may say, what kind of plan is that? Let's see what's happening. But Esther has a second track in addition to the political diplomacy that she's engaging in with Ahasuerus. The second track is tefillah and fasting, to ask HaKadosh Baruch Hu to intercede in such a way so that she can utilize it for political diplomacy. Leich Kenosis Kol HaYehudim, she goes to Mordechai and says, look, I'm going to work the diplomatic end. I need Klal Yisrael to work the spiritual end and to fast and to daven. What are they fasting and davening for? Yes, they're fasting and davening that the decree should come to an end, but on a more specific level, they're fasting and davening that something should happen to break the incredible trust that Ahasuerus has in Haman. That spectacular moment comes, of course, in Perek Vav, in the sixth chapter, when Ahasuerus can't sleep, and Haman comes in with the plan to hang Mordechai on the gallows, And in the course of that conversation that Ahasuerus has with Haman in the middle of the night, it's clear that Ahasuerus's absolute trust in Haman begins to crack ever so much. Because I'll put a finger on it when they say that Haman suggests to Ahasuerus that the person whom the king wishes to honor should be paraded through the streets with the royal crown on his head. The Chazal already say, Ahasuerus says, wait a minute, somebody else is wearing the royal crown? That doesn't sound so good. Again, remember, he's paranoid. Somebody else? You're suggesting that somebody other than myself should be wearing the royal crown? I need to rethink this relationship I have with Haman. And that begins to crack the perception of the king, his perception that Haman is his savior at his side, would do anything to protect him. And already it's laying the groundwork for the king to start seeing Haman not as his protector, but as his adversary. That's what leads Esther to make her move at the second feast. The impression you get from Rav Soloveitchik is that had that episode not happened at that time, so Esther would have kept just stretching the whole thing out. Let's have a third feast. Let's have a fourth feast. Let's have a fifth feast. It would be like Israeli elections, right? let's just keep going and going and going, and you know we'll keep playing this out till what? Till something happens. Eventually, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to make. Yeah, you know, HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to make something happen. We hope. Right? We believe HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to make something happen. So I'll keep schlepping it out until I see that the moment is ripe, that Ahasuerus' confidence in Haman is beginning to wane. So you'll say, I mean, how long is she going to schlep it out already? So I think the answer to that would be, this is the king who made a party for 180 days. You know? So, you know, a third feast and a fourth feast and a fifth feast and a sixth feast, you know, wouldn't necessarily have been unreasonable. So the question, which, by the way, is asked in the Gemara, why did Esther make the second feast? According to Rav Soloveitchik, the answer to that is just, well, she saw that it was time. There was nothing about two feasts per se. She didn't go in. She didn't go into the king thinking, this is my plan. We're going to have a first feast and then a second feast. Basically, she was waiting for the right moment, and she was prepared to string Ahasuerus out and to have feasts with Ahasuerus and Haman every single night, if need be, until that magic moment would appear when she would see that Ahasuerus was primed to no longer, you know, see Haman as a protector, but as someone who is an enemy.
But even in general, when you meet someone for the first time, you don't mean to say, fine, how are you, and let me ask you every favor.
Right.
Instead of to get comfortable and know the person, and then you can ask if they were getting drunk a little bit. And
right,
and
right.
And she was probably a pretty woman, and, you know, and...
Right, right. So, she was stretching it out.
When she was at Ahasuerus originally, was that her plan, or did she decide, I mean, obviously we don't know, did she decide that what she neck and face on that... I can't just ask my request right away.
So the way Rav Soloveitchik seems to present it is she didn't really have a plan.
Until she actually got into
it. Yeah, in other words, she was waiting for that moment. You know, she knows that I can't go to Ahasuerus right away and just say, by the way, would you mind canceling the decree? She knows that he'd probably execute her on the spot. So I have to somehow get him to turn against Haman. How will I get him to turn against Haman? I have confidence that HaKadosh Baruch Hu is going to make a magic moment happen where after that I can begin to turn the tables.
Everything's a magic moment. They even said, yes, I'm going to come to a party somewhere I have no idea where you are.
Well, no, again, she is his wife, right? In other words, they are, you know, they do have that, yeah, they do have that, yeah, you know, they do have that connection already at that point. You know, they are married, right? But again, you know, just because you're married to Ahasuerus doesn't mean that he likes you, right? I mean, he can still, you know, take your head off, you know, at a moment's provocation. You know, so she's waiting for that moment, she's waiting for that moment, she's waiting for that moment, finally that moment comes. And the clincher, of course, as we know, is that when she tells Ahasuerus about how Haman is doing something harmful, Ahasuerus picks up in his anger, leaves to the garden, comes back, and has the impression that Haman is trying to seduce Esther. So if Haman is trying to seduce Esther, that means for sure he's not my friend anymore. He's for sure against me. And the paranoia of Ahasuerus kicks in, and he says, this is not my friend, this is not my protector. He's pretended to be my protector all this time in order to hurt me in some way or another. The Rav also points to a very subtle diplomatic trick that Esther uses when talking to Ahasuerus. Says Esther to Ahasuerus, there's somebody who wants to kill my entire people. Had that individual simply wanted to sell us as slaves, I wouldn't have said anything. But this way, to kill us, I feel that I have to speak up. What's that line? You know, had he just wanted to sell us into slavery, that would have been fine. That would have been fine, really? You know, what does that mean? So, according to the Rav, Esther says the following to Ahasuerus. It's clear that Haman doesn't have your best interests in mind. Because from the point of view of the king, the best way to deal with a group of people who you want to subjugate is what? Is to use them, you know, put them in labor camps, right? Send them off to Siberia, have them work over there, right? No, have them do stuff. This way, they'll be subjugated. They'll be in camps, you know. They'll be in labor camps, but they'll also produce things on behalf of the empire. You're just going to kill them? What does the king get out of that? Obviously, whoever made that suggestion has some other motive other than the protection of the king. Obviously, this person is not working for the king. The person is really working for themselves and trying to use the king. And that plants a seed also in Ahasuerus' head. Wait a minute, you know, that's true. You know, that's a good argument. You know, if Haman had really wanted to help me, he would have advised me to just subjugate the Jews, put them in labor camps. But to kill them? You're right. What do I get out of that? He must be against me. All of these are diplomatic tricks that Esther is utilizing with tremendous cunning. That's the Rav's word. She has tremendous cunning, tremendous insight in basically psychologically manipulating the paranoid Ahasuerus against Haman, so that when the moment comes, it's easy for Ahasuerus to dismiss Haman, to hang him, and to get rid of the whole decree which Haman had put into place, because this paranoid individual has been turned against Haman the same way that he had been turned against Vashti and turned against the Jews. A paranoid person is going to be against the people that he suspects are against him. You just have to swivel him and manipulate him to make sure that his paranoia is focused on those people whom it should be focused on, as opposed to being, you know, you yourself. So the Rav Soloveitchik says, so we see in Esther this tremendous cunning, this tremendous bina yisera, this excess insight into the way people operate. She has this intuitive understanding of human nature, where she can really, you know, play Ahasuerus in such a way that she can take him and turn him around. Mordechai would have failed had he gone to Ahasuerus. Mordechai would have just come in there with a big sign: Jews are slated for destruction, we must do something. And Ahasuerus would have said, okay, off with your head too. You know, it wouldn't have gotten anywhere. Esther knew how to play Ahasuerus. But at the same time, says the Rav, Esther knew how to get people to daven and approach HaKadosh Baruch Hu in that way. And the Rav Zatzal makes a very fascinating observation about prayer. The best people when it comes to prayer are people who lack cunning, who lack sophistication, and have the simplicity of a child. He says very, very beautifully, you ever give a child something that child really, really wants, they're so thankful, they jump up and down, thank you, 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 without any regard for, you know, what's socially appropriate or anything like that. Same thing, if you're ever in a toy store with a young child, and the child really wants something, they also have a way of asking, which may not be necessarily socially appropriate or helpful, but, you know, they'll throw themselves on the ground, they'll start pounding the ground, you know, adults verbally sometimes do the same thing, but at least they know that, you know, physically it's not really socially appropriate to throw yourself on the ground and start, you know, banging the ground with your fists because you want something in the toy store. But the child, because the child has this sort of simplicity, they just know to ask from the depths of their hearts and to say thank you from the depths of their hearts. And that simplicity is really, says the Rav, what tefillah, what real, you know, prayer is all about. Not that we have to necessarily throw ourselves on the ground every time we want something from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. But as adults, we become a little bit more sophisticated, a little bit more jaded. And, you know, our asking for something is not always from the depths of our hearts. Our thank you is not always from the depths of our hearts. There has to be a certain childlike nature to really be able to daven in the best possible way. Esther was a master, mistress, of being able to combine the cunning in terms of dealing with people and the diplomacy that she had with the incredible simplicity of a child. She was able to inspire the Jewish people to daven, which took the simplicity of a child, just call out to Hashem from the depths of your heart. And at the same time, in dealing with people, she was not childish at all. She was incredibly mature, incredibly sophisticated in terms of how she was able to do those things. Because Esther, more than any other person in the story, combined that cunning on the one hand with that incredible simplicity on the other hand, says the Rav, that's why it's called Megillas Esther. Because she was able to take two seemingly contradictory character traits and put them both together in a way that was for the benefit of Klal Yisrael. The Rav adds that that's the special characteristic of the Jewish woman, as a general rule, that Esther is really supposed to be a paradigm for the Jewish woman. On the one hand, that incredible insight, that diplomacy, the understanding of human nature, which is intuitive. On the other hand, that incredible emotional simplicity on many levels, where the person just, you know, cries out from the depths of their hearts, expresses emotion from the depths of their hearts. That's really the legacy that Esther leaves the Jewish woman in particular. Halavai, as we go into Purim, we should embrace that legacy, the cunning and the simplicity all together, and we should be zocha to all of the gulos that are associated with Purim.